This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
I welcome you, our listeners, from the United States and many countries around the world to the ICERM Radio program, Let's Talk About It. I want to thank you for your support and passion for global peace and security, and for joining us again this week to promote interethnic and interreligious cooperation. Broadcasting live from New York, I am your host, Basil Ogorji. Peace and blessings to you. For those who didn't have time to join us on the air last week, we had an interesting conversation on interreligious conflict resolution with Dr. Mohammed Abunimer, a professor at the School of International Service, American University, and a senior advisor at the Kaiser Center. One of the questions that emerged from last week's discussion has to do with the role of history and collective memory in conflict resolution. It is believed that history and collective memory of traumatic and painful events such as terrorist attacks, mass murder, ethnic cleansing, genocide, or any other traumatic experience caused by war, violence, or abuse could make an existing conflict intractable. Our goal is not to examine in details the nature, causes, actors, patterns, or dynamics of these atrocities and the level of trauma and pain they have inflicted on humanity, especially on the victims, their families, and the affected societies and nations. For today's interview and discussion, however, it is our intention to focus on how to deal with memory and collective memory in history, especially how to deal with history and collective memory in conflict resolution. We're going to be doing this with our distinguished guest, Dr. Cheryl Duckworth, a professor of conflict resolution at Nova Southeastern University, Florida. Before we formally introduce our guest for today's show and bring her on the air, it is important that we understand the context of today's conversation. After the experience of a horrific or traumatic event like the four coordinated terrorist attacks that occurred in the United States of America on the morning of September 11, 2001, which killed nearly 3,000 people from 93 nations and left thousands of people wounded, according to the 9/11 Memorial website, or the 1994 Rwandan genocide, where an estimated 800,000 to 1 million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by extremist Hutus within a period of 100 days. And an estimated 100,000 to 250,000 women raped during the 3 months of genocide, thousands of people wounded, millions of refugees forced to flee, in addition to the loss of property and psychological trauma and health crises, according to the United Nations Department of Public Information, the Outreach Program on the Rwandan Genocide and the United Nations. We can't forget the 1967 massacre of the Biafrans in Nigeria during the Nigerian Civil War, a three-year bloody war that sent more than 1 million people to their graves, in addition to millions of civilians, including children and women, who died from starvation during the war. Now, after the occurrence of traumatic events like these, the ones we've just mentioned, policymakers usually they come together to decide whether or not to tell and transmit the story about what happened. And the same thing is going to be taking place in Syria and Iraq. It's going to be taking place in Central African Republic, where Christians, Muslims fought and many people were killed. The same thing is going to be taking place in many other places. Stories like these will be told after the San Bernardino attack, terrorist attack. And stories like these will be told after the attack in Orlando. In the case of 9/11, there is a consensus that 9/11 should be taught in U.S. classrooms. But the question that comes to mind is, what narrative or story about what happened is being transmitted to students? And how is this narrative taught in U.S. schools? In the case of the Rwandan genocide, the post-genocide education policy of the Rwandan government, led by Paul Kagame, seeks to abolish the classification of learners and teachers by Hutu, Tutsi, or Tua affiliation. And this is honestly a report that is found on the UNESCO UNESCO-led report, which is entitled "Never Again: Educational Reconstruction in Rwanda," written by Anna Obora. And in addition, the Paul Kagame's government is hesitant to allow the history of the Rwandan genocide to be taught in schools. Similarly, many Nigerians who were born after the Nigeria-Biafra War, especially those from the southeastern part of Nigeria, the Biafra land, a place called Biafra land, have been asking why were they not taught the history of the Nigeria-Biafra War in school? Why was the story about the Nigeria-Biafra War hidden from the public arena, especially from the school curriculum? Approaching today's discussion on how to deal with history and collective memory in conflict resolution from a peace education perspective, we'll focus on the most important thematic issues in Dr. Duckworth's book, Teaching About Terror, 9/11 and Collective Memory in U.S. Classrooms. And we're going to be looking at their practical application to conflict resolution, conflict prevention, conflict transformation, especially through peace education. Why comparing teaching about terror in U.S. classrooms with the current revisionist post-1994 Rwandan genocide, the Rwandan genocide educational reconstruction, that very approach that Paul Kagame has instituted. And the Nigerian politics of oblivion, which means to forget memory and forget history regarding the Nigeria-Biafra War. Dr. Duckworth's teaching and research focus on transforming the social, cultural, political, and economic causes of war and violence. She regularly lectures and presents workshops on historical memory, peace education, conflict resolution, and qualitative research methods. Among her recent publications, A Conflict Resolution and the Scholarship of Engagement, and Teaching About Terror, 9/11 and Collective Memory in U.S. Classrooms. The book that analyzes the narrative today's students are receiving about 9/11 and the implications of this for global peace and conflict. Dr. Duckworth is currently the editor-in-chief of Peace and Conflict Studies Journal. We are honored to have Dr. Duckworth on the ICN Radio program. Let's talk about it. Dr. Duckworth, we just want to use this opportunity to thank you so much for being on the show with us today to share your expert knowledge on history and collective memory.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you so much, Dr. Duckworth. It's going to be an engaging conversation, no doubt. And to you, our listeners, and all those who have called in to ask questions or add their voice to the conversation, once again, I welcome you to this important discussion. We want you to relax and make yourself comfortable. This is going to be a public dialogue. So feel free to call into the show, add your voice to the conversation, and make your views known to the world. The number to call is 323-642-1236. Again, To ask questions or add your voice to the conversation, call 323-642-1236. If you're outside the United States listening to this conversation right now and you want to call in, you must dial 1 before 323-642-1236. Dr. Duckworth, I'm going to be turning to you because this is just amazing having you. You have inspired a lot of people, including me. Have taught me many courses that I've taken from you at Nova, Nova Southeastern University. And I really enjoyed your methodology, the wealth of knowledge that you transmit to your students. And in fact, some of the knowledge that I gained from you is actually being utilized here at the ISON radio program and also in the work that we do at the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation. But again, I want to ask you if you could please briefly tell us a little bit about you and why you decided to join the conflict resolution field.
Well, thank you so much, Basil, for those really kind words. You and so many of my students inspire me with the amazing work that you all do out in the world and in communities. So I just am very, very pleased to be here. I believe, why did I join the field of conflict resolution? It was a field that rejects the idea that, scholarship should just stay in a library. I love libraries. They're one of my favorite places to be. But this is an applied field. It's an interdisciplinary field. And it's the only field that I came across that took seriously the idea of Maria Montessori's call for a science of peace, right? Mm. We have a science of war. We need a science of peace. We need to understand the conditions that help bring about peace, things such as equality, the ability to be heard, shared resources.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And these are really great, great reasons, and they come with a lot of sacrifice. Not everyone will really want to embark on such a profession that is actually aimed at promoting peace. Many people are out there thinking about war. Many people are thinking about military intervention. Other ways of managing conflict. And here you are saying that peace is very important, that peace is better than war, and peace is better than every other thing that we can think about here in the world. Without peace, there will not be development. Without peace, there will not be progress, even in any country, actually, that you can think about. And again, that is very important when it comes to the fundamental reason why you went into your research, researching how 9/11 is being taught in schools. And 9/11 still remains one of the most horrific terrorist attacks in world history, a horrific event that killed nearly 3,000 people from 93 nations on that very day, and left thousands of people wounded. This is actually according to the 9/11 Memorial website. Could you share with us and our listeners what you recall, what you can recall about 9/11 and what actually happened that day?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Like so many of us, it's a day that I will not ever, ever forget. I was in my classroom. I was teaching ninth grade at the time. My ninth grade class was coming. I believe it was second or third period. And as I relate in the book that you referred to on teaching about terror, I could literally go to the spot in the classroom where I was standing. That's how vividly I remember it. I remember the student. He was kind of a class clown, so I didn't really know whether or not to believe him at first. until we turned on the television that was in the classroom. He came in and said, you need to turn on the television, Ms. Duckworth. I said, what's going on? He said, no, this is really very serious. I was in Virginia at the time, Northern Virginia, which is right outside of D.C. We had a lot of kids whose parents worked at the Pentagon, or maybe at Langley or one of the other bases around. There's a lot of military in that area. And over the coming months, it became clear to me that, of course, we tried to take care of each other. We tried to take care of our students. But I didn't see much of an educational curriculum response, mm-hmm. right, to what had happened and to trying to help students make sense of it. I remember one of my students telling me, she was one of my ninth graders, this was, again, back when I was teaching high school English, telling me that, none of her other teachers really addressed it at all. Mm-hmm. I had placed some pictures up in the classroom of, vigils and memorials and support from around the world. I opened up my classroom kind of throughout the year, maybe on a Friday afternoon or something like this, to, what's on your mind, what do you want to know? Just sort of an open forum.
Mm-hmm.
And it really struck me that students wanted to hear from the adults in their lives what this meant, why it had happened. They were scared. They were angry.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't really prepared to respond from a pedagogical point of view or from a curriculum kind of point of view. I wasn't okay with that. Because I know how important schools are to shaping the worldview of kids, of all of us. The worldview that we inherit from our schooling stays with us throughout our lives.
And I wonder how those students must have felt when they heard that the World Trade Center was hit, and when they heard in the news, when they watched what was going on the television, or when their parents texted them or even called to ask about the safety of their children in school. I wonder what was going on in your mind, Dr. Duckworth. And that brings me to this very important question that I must ask. What impacts do you think 9/11 has on young people, especially the students that you were with that very day?
I think it had a profound impact. I think it had a profound impact that we may be only beginning to understand. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of research done on this. And from a historical memory kind of point of view, it's not really history yet. I think we're still racing to keep up. So when I think of the impact, I think of things like the rise of Islamophobia,
mm-hmm.
which is a real concern to me. I think of these young people, and even young people today, right? My middle schoolers and high schoolers in 2001, they've graduated, college presumably, and started their careers. But today's middle schoolers and high schoolers have almost entirely only grown up in what I call the 9/11 era, which has been an era of securitization of almost everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Militarized policing. Infiltration of mosques, by the NYPD, kids don't know a world where you don't take off your shoes, at least in the U.S., to get on an airplane. And people can argue whether or not that's the right approach or not, but what is the impact? How does this affect a young person's relationship with the state, right, with their government?
Mm-hmm.
And what are they going to expect in terms of freedoms, liberties, human rights? From their government, having grown up in this really securitized era.
And that's very important, Dr. Duckworth. In many places or many countries where we have such horrific event, especially right now we experience what is going on in Syria, we experience what is going on in Iraq, we also saw in 1994 the genocide, the mass killing of one population the Tutsis in Rwanda and the moderate Hutus in Rwanda. And when it was going on, the world kept quiet, apart from a few people in a few countries. And United Nations tried a lot of it. But again, Belgium withdrew its military, those who went as peacekeepers from the UN troop. But again, it's actually very confusing because of the history between Belgium and Rwanda before the genocide. And again, they decided to send troops. The UN decided to include about 90% of the troop, the peacekeepers, came from Belgium at that time. But again, when it hit, they had to withdraw, which created a vacuum that led to what we see today as something that is unthinkable. The mass murder of almost a million people. How do you think about this? How do you teach such horrific event to students? And this is why, most probably, because of the fears that you raised, those fears might be the reason why Paul Kagame tried to prevent, remove that from the curriculum after the genocide. I want to ask you about the aftermath of 9/11 with respect to educational policy. How did 9/11 affect the educational policy? Were there policy debates on whether to teach 9/11 or not to teach it in schools?
Right. That's a really fascinating question. There is a pretty broad consensus that it has to be taught, right? One of the fascinating things that I learned from the teachers that I was speaking with, though, is that there just really is not a lot of room in the curriculum, right? We're in an era, at least in U.S. schools, where curriculum has become very rigid, very narrow, sort of back to the basics. And really, teachers have lost control of their classrooms, right? Mm-hmm. Teachers have been promoted to proctors. And so one of the things when I interviewed teachers for the book Teaching About Terror, they were describing a situation in which they have very little choice as to whether or not they can bring 9/11 in the classroom. They'll do sort of memorial kind of lessons, right? Maybe show a documentary or talk a little bit about memories, if they do anything at all. But broadly, it's not taught, right, broadly speaking. It's only on, or at least this was true as of 2 years ago. This may have changed a little bit now, but it's only on the curriculum in about 20 states, which isn't even half the country. Despite the fact that there seems to be a lot of support for, yes, it's important, it should be taught. And definitely the kids appreciate it. So, it's really fascinating. It sounds to me from what you're describing, in the case of Rwanda, there was a decision that we're not ready for this yet. And we can talk about sort of how to think about that. What's the wisest choice to make? That's a very, very complicated question. But here in the U.S., really, it's been this kind of bureaucratic, state-controlled emphasis on high-stakes testing that has crowded out 9/11 and so much else.
This is very important, very, very important. The same analogy could be made as well with respect to what happened in Nigeria after the Civil War, 1967. In 1967, Nigeria went into war with Biafra. Biafra is a region from the southeastern part of Nigeria. At that point, they were, they wanted actually to separate from Nigeria and declare an independent state of Biafra. And the war lasted for about 3 years. And that war sent more than a million people to their graves. And honestly, many Nigerians, especially those who are born or were born after the war are still asking themselves and asking their government, why is the history of Biafra, Biafran War, why is that history, the memory, why is it hidden from the school curriculum? Young people are asking, why did the Nigerian government remove that part from the Nigeria history that is presented to them in school? And most probably, it could be as a result of vengeance. They wouldn't want these students to kind of grow knowing what happened. And at a point, maybe revenge, especially those who have been wounded, heavily wounded. Do you think here in the U.S., that that could actually teaching 9/11 in schools might actually affect the very relationship you're talking about, given that those who perpetrated the terrorists themselves are from a different religious persuasion. With that cause, knowing what happened, the knowledge of what happened that day, would that really cause some kind of sentiments or retaliation against the Islamic community?
Yeah, that's a profoundly important question. And I guess it saddens me to have to say, I think that we are already seeing this, right? Schools are hugely key to how kids, experience the world. But it's not the only, there are faith-based institutions, of course, parents, the media, community leaders, and there has been so much free-floating Islamophobia out there in U.S. policy, in U.S. leadership. A major presidential candidate, as we all know, is sort of institutionalizing Islamophobia, proposing to. In the proposal to ban Muslims from entering the country, surveilling mosques, things along these lines. Kids pick up on that. They pick up on it, through the curriculum, of course, from parents, from the media, from our political leadership, from the culture at large, the TVs and movies that they watch. Mm-hmm. So what we're already seeing is certainly not on anything, thank God, on along the scale of a Rwanda, but we are already seeing escalated bullying of Muslim or so-called suspect Muslim students, and it outrages me to say, as an educator, some of this is not just coming from the other kids; it's coming from teachers. We've seen this here in Florida, where I am, Florida, there have been some teachers here in Florida, I believe this is true of other states as well, who directed racial slurs at Muslim students. It really has been a very, very terrible situation, and this has to be interrupted, right? Once this kind of cycle, and I think this is just probably the most important insight from this kind of intersection of collective memory and conflict resolution. Once this cycle, as you've been stating, of vengeance and mutual hostility and mutual suspicion gets going, it can be very, very difficult to interrupt. And so what I want to see is pedagogy, school policy, curriculum that actively intervenes, right, to interrupt the vengeance and the bullying that we're already seeing, not just from kid to kid, but also from adult to kid.
Wonderful. And we're going to be talking about that important aspect of your book, which has to do with peace education. It's one thing to agree on a policy level that 9/11 is going to be taught in U.S. classrooms. It's another thing to know what exactly is being transmitted to students. How is it taught in schools? And again, from another perspective, it is also important to understand how students themselves react to it. What are their reactions? Or how do they accept what is being taught to them? Now, if what is presented to them is serving as something that could lead to some kind of reactions, some kind of revenge, what are other ways that this could be taught? And I think this is the essence of your book. And we're going to be looking at these questions as soon as we return from this short break.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners. Those who have joined us who are on our website are listening to this important conversation, or those who have called into our studio to listen, contribute to this important conversation on history and collective memory in conflict resolution with Professor Cheryl Duckworth, a professor of conflict analysis and resolution at Nova Southeastern University. We want to let our listeners know that you can call in to ask your questions. So we have an opportunity for you to interact and share your views on this very important topic that we're discussing. And our guest, Dr. Duckworth, is here to respond to your important questions. Dr. Duckworth, let's look at peace education, especially after 9/11. From your research on teaching about terror on 9/11 and collective memory in U.S. classrooms, what are your findings with respect to how teachers are teaching 9/11 in the classrooms?
The findings were quite varied. By and large, it's not being taught. Most teachers are not really addressing it at all. Startlingly, even the history teachers, and when they do, it tends to be only on 9/11 itself, right, the date of commemoration, when maybe a documentary will be shown or a guest speaker brought in, if that. There were some really exciting exceptions to this, though, and maybe it'll be useful to talk about that as well, because there were some teachers who sort of were just bound and determined, even if it, you know, frankly meant ignoring the state curriculum, you know, would build really exciting units about 9/11 and get kids engaged in debate and dialogue around Islamophobia, human rights, a broad and complicated view of history, right? And if you think about it, if you're an 11th or 12th grade history teacher, for example, it's a challenging unit, right? You've got to teach kids a little bit about the Cold War, a little bit maybe about Southeast Asian history, all kinds of U.S. history to help them make sense, right? Because it was not just a day. No event in history is just a day. So the curriculum that I saw that was the most exciting did a couple of important things. One, it used oral history in order to help kids not just be readers of history and students of history, but authors of history, right? Mm-hmm. And so kids would be invited to maybe interview mom or dad or an older brother or sister, somebody who remembered 9/11, and then come in and talk about, you know, what they learned from the interview. So kids are actually getting engaged with making history here. And secondly, a lot of teachers, I wish I could say a lot, the teachers who really were determined to use their classroom as a place of peace, and there are a lot of them out there.
Wonderful.
Find lessons that would...
Mm-hmm. Yes, go ahead.
Well, they designed lessons that would interrupt stereotypes about Islamophobia, right? Maybe through guest speakers or documentaries, or posing questions such as, you know, who is a terrorist? Right, and kind of complicating that notion as well. Right, there have been terrorists, for example, from all different nationalities, ethnicities, and faiths. So interrupting that narrative of Islamophobia was important too.
And this is very important. And again, it said that about 93 nations, people from 93 nations, were honestly involved, you know, a part of the victims of 9/11. And so it's just very, very important to understand that what happened affected people from many countries, including people from Islamic nations. So your proposal is very important, and it should be taken seriously. I want to ask you again, Dr. Duckworth, another important question on peace education. Now, I know you mentioned how our students were reacting and how the teachers themselves are actually were teaching 9/11, and a little bit about your proposal. But again, if you can kind of let us know from your findings, if the awareness, you may reference to it a little bit, but if you can expatiate and elaborate, if the awareness of this event, just as the awareness of the Rwandan genocide to the Hutus or the Tutsis who are born after the genocide, or the awareness of the massacre of Biafrans in Nigeria to the Biafrans who are born after the 1967 war, the awareness of all this, remembering all this, do you think this could create conditions for revenge, conditions for retaliation?
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I do. Because of evidence that we're already seeing. We're already seeing revenge of you know some of a very real sort in the wide.
Since we actually lost our guest. Okay, are you here? Oh, back. Great.
Hello?
Go ahead, Doc. Yeah, go ahead. We actually had a technical problem at the time. We couldn't hear you, but I'm glad you're back. So you can continue with the explanation you were giving to the very question that I asked you with respect to revenge.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's such an important question. Unfortunately, I do think that we are already seeing cycles of revenge in motion. You know, if you think of the Burn a Koran Day that a Florida pastor wanted to sponsor, if you think of the proposal of a major party candidate in the U.S. to refuse Muslims entry to the country, kids absorb that, right? This tells them essentially that they have permission from the adults to bully. It tells them in many real ways that, and this is a difficult look in the mirror for adults to take, but it tells them that violence is acceptable as a way to respond to events like 9/11. So unfortunately, I believe that those cycles are already in place, and a response is required to interrupt them before it escalates further.
Wonderful interruption. And we're going to be taking a short break, Dr. Duckworth. And we have a few callers here who I suppose would want to contribute to this conversation by asking questions or sharing their views on the very topic that we are actually discussing, history and memory, collective memory in conflict resolution. When we come back, we'll be a kind of discussing what Dr. Duckworth is proposing with respect to how 9/11 traumatic experience and traumatic events could be taught in schools in such a way that it's actually going to promote peace and not revenge. We're going to be looking at that immediately after this short break.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, all those who have joined us from many countries, who are listening on our website, those who are listening on other channels, networks, where we are broadcasting this conversation live. I want to welcome you back to this important conversation. Please, if you have questions, you can send them to our chat box. We just opened our chat box. Send in your questions, and we're going to transmit them to our guest, the esteemed guest for today's conversation, Dr. Duckworth, who is a professor at Nova Southeastern University in Florida, teaching conflict analysis and resolution. Dr. Duckworth, maybe I think it's important, and actually it's time to look at ways, the various ways you think teaching the very history and collective memory of war, traumatic events, genocide or terrorist attack, especially the lessons you learned from your book, writing your book, how in what ways do you think teaching the history and collective memory of war, genocide, or terrorist attack will serve as an opportunity for conflict transformation?
Absolutely. I think the important lesson there for young people is to help them be able to see the warning signs of escalated violence. To help them, break down just simple concepts such as stereotypes, right? What is a stereotype? What is scapegoating, right? Even students in late elementary school, middle school, certainly high school, can grasp those. But I think it's important to go beyond that too. A lot of curriculum involves this. I think we need to make the connections, though, between those sorts of, concepts like stereotypes and scapegoating that we often teach kids, and explicitly make the connection to mass violence that has occurred, right? The kinds of things that we've been talking about in Rwanda and Nigeria and on 9/11. They don't always make that connection, right, to how something as simple as a stereotype. A rumor, scapegoating, can lead to really terrible political violence. And in fact, not only that it can, it has. They need to know those kinds of historical examples.
Wonderful. And there are so many historical models or examples out there that could actually be, we could actually learn from. But again, one of the important problems or important questions that many people have honestly raised with respect to what is going on around the world, and you are aware that after the Cold War, as Liderac actually said, Jean-Paul Liderac in his book, that what we experience now mostly international, intrastate or war. Mm-hmm. And this kind of conflict somehow also helps in building alliances at the international level and also alliances at the regional level. One example is the Biafra war. We're talking about Biafra and Rwanda with respect to how to teach history and collective memory, because they are very, very important. In Nigeria, there is a big problem because of what happened in 1967. The Biafran people right now, since 2015, have reignited the agitation for the independent state of Biafra. And there were massive protests since in 2015. And that has continued both locally and at the international level. Now, if we look at the time frame, this happened in 67. And in 2015, 2016, because this history was not taught, because the memory, traumatic experiences were not actually dealt with as you have proposed. These were not transformed. the problem has recycled. We see have a kind of, you know, reawakened. Now we have seen them again reemerged, and this could happen in Rwanda. But we're not praying that this happens in Rwanda. Rwandan case is 1994, and if this is not taught, if people are not aware, young generation are not given the true story with respect to what happened, if the traumatic experiences are not a kind of taken care of, this memory, bad, painful memory, is not well healed through the awareness, but again, a constructive, transformative, through a transformative approach. So we also are afraid that, you know, there's going to be some kind of problem in the near future, as it is happening right now in Nigeria. So I just wanted to let our listeners, or those who are listening right now, know what your views are. How could we come what is going on in those countries as a result of history not being taught and painful memories not well dealt with?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think you make a really key point in terms of the pain, the guilt, when a mass atrocity such as the ones you've been describing or 9/11 occurs. There's also often involved a lot of shame, a sense of complicity. You see this in all of the conflict that accompanied the breakup of Yugoslavia. And because of that, it becomes incredibly difficult to talk about. And it can become very tempting to just avoid. My recommendation is that it can't be avoided. We need to equip young people and not so young people with the actual skills to be able to heal, to regulate emotions, to dialogue across these lines of division, to recognize things like superordinate goals, which are goals that, you know, a variety of different communities might share in common, such as development, such as national unity. You know, these things are really very, very key, and I think often we just don't feel equipped to really take it on. But there are a couple of really brilliant sort of innovations that have kind of come out of one of these, and maybe one will be useful. For example, Israel and Palestine, of course, remains unfortunately mired in conflict. Teachers can't replace political leadership or economic leadership, but one of the really brilliant things that they've done is started to co-write textbooks, right? So that all, and what the important thing about this is that it allows for a multiplicity of narratives about conflicted history, contested history. This helps students absorb that complexity, so that they aren't only hearing one side of the story, so that they don't only have an impression from one group of what it was that was happened, while another group is sort of marginalized and silenced. Sarah Cobb, one of my favorite scholars on this subject, on narrative mediation, calls this a more ironic story, right? Because once you hear the story of the other come back to you, your worldview becomes more complex, more resilient, and you may even begin to see the ways in which your own identity group contributed to the conflict, which ultimately is really essential. People resist it. It's very controversial. But this creation of a more ironic story, right, where people can see how their own behavior contributed to the conflict as well, is really essential. There's no such thing as a one-sided story.
Wonderful. Great point, Dr. Duckworth. We have some questions here in our chat box that a few listeners have sent for us to transmit to you. We're going to be taking a short break, and when we come back, I will present some of these questions to you.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, or those who have joined us for this important conversation on history and collective memory in conflict resolution. We have in our studio Dr. Cheryl Duckworth, a professor of conflict resolution at Southeastern University in Florida. Dr. Duckworth, the first question that we have is from Michael. Michael sent the question from Maryland. And Michael is asking you, what is the role of social media in the reawakening of painful memory?
In the reawakening, that's a brilliant question. And social media can be put to uses of violence and conflict. It can be put to uses of peace and development and social justice. One of the things that I think teachers can do in the classroom is use social media, things like Twitter, Skype, Facebook, in order to connect kids with one another and across these conflict lines, or just to connect kids with those of other cultures in general, right, to begin to expand their awareness. One of the things that I think peace education should do is begin to sort of shake loose ethnocentricity, right, egocentricity, and so exposure to other views, other cultures, just that exposure alone can at least begin that process, and social media can be really brilliant for that. Teachers can also, you know, call attention to online bullying that you'll see take place a lot of times on social media, and help kids learn how to reject it and not be a bystander.
That's very important, Dr. Duckworth. A lot is going on social media these days. Most of the most of the groups that are formed to revitalize painful memories and history, are done, honestly, some of these are done, first of all, on social media. I've been doing a lot of research these days, looking at those groups on social media. And when you tune in to listen, to read what is written, what is shared, I mean, you will get very surprised. It's just, somehow you become scared that something is going to happen within a few days. So social media is really very important in this. We have another question, Dr. Duckworth, from John. John is from France, Paris, listening to this important conversation right now. And John is asking you if painful memory is not well dealt with through a psychotherapeutic means, do you not think that this could again resurface?
Right. Well, I think that John has put his finger right on the heart of the problem. Vamik Fokan, who's one of the classic theorists of this, he talks about the failure to mourn. Right. In the wake of these kinds of atrocities, we have to mourn. And we have to allow ourselves that space, both collectively and as individuals. And so, yes, absolutely. I think that if we don't allow ourselves to go through that process, that can even further entrench us in these cycles of fear, of hatred, of revenge. The question then becomes how, you know, what's the difference between a kind of mourning without end and the kind of mourning that will help us lead to at least some kind of healing. And to me, we need a combined look at both the future and at the past in order to procure a kind of mourning that will allow us to heal and grieve and feel our sadness and trauma and sorrow. And then come out the other side.
That's very important response. And again, a very important question from John, as you said. That process of healing leads to transformation, transforming the experience of pain, experience of painful traumatic events. A lot of people actually need that now as we're speaking, or especially victims and their children. And again, if these are not taught in public schools or even in a public place, there is also oral history. Families transmit history, transmit their memories, what they remember, to their children. And this is very important. And I want to ask you, in addition to the other questions that we have, what do you think is the transgenerational significance of some of these painful memories? So how do we understand it from a transgenerational perspective?
Right. That is a key question. Absolutely. And one of the really fascinating things that scientists are discovering recently, and this is still a new, controversial, but there does look like there's evidence that trauma can be transmitted through one's DNA. The kids and grandkids of survivors of the Holocaust, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do we do with this, right? We have to first help the victims heal. But if this is true, that the trauma of the slavery, for example, is in the DNA, then what we need is a therapeutic response, a community response in terms of policy, resources, support. Otherwise, these cycles of violence will continue, the cycles of violence and revenge. So the fact that it shows up so physically, if this research does bear out, it can be seen in our DNA is very startling, and I think speaks to the urgency of the kind of response that we need.
Mm. Very important. And Dr. Duckworth, I don't know if you know René Lomachin. René Lomachin is a very important person who has done a lot of work in the Great Lakes region, region, especially in Burundi and Rwanda. And one of his publications is Remembering Forgotten Genocides. And he tried to re-examine what he refers to as the occurrence of genocide in Burundi that led to the genocide that we have, we all know, that occurred in Rwanda. And his argument, René Lomachin, is that the Burundian genocide has been forgotten. And it occurred in 1972. And that important event has been forgotten and nobody remembers it. But again, it's very important for him that if you want to understand what happened in Rwanda, then you have to understand actually what happened in 1972, that in Burundi, many of those people who actually perpetrated the Rwandan genocide were also massacred in Burundi. And so his argument that we have to remember, and the question as to why remember, why should we remember? I asked René Lomachin that question. Why should we remember that long ago, centuries ago, traumatic experiences that happened years ago? And he said that the quick answer is that they involve the lives and death of millions of people, who, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is hatred or the other. Now, he said, we have to remember these people who were wiped off the face of the earth, because these people, honestly, were human beings like us. So when we try to keep that secret and, you know, prevent people, generations, from discovering what happened, that it's going to be a time when this truth will manifest again. And the same problems that led to those traumatic experiences will begin again. Now, of course, that's exactly what you have been talking about, Dr. Duckworth. What is your reaction to Rene Lomachon's theory on why we should remember forgotten genocides?
I would say a couple of if we don't remember forgotten genocides or other atrocities, things that we may not think of a genocide, such as slavery, Jim Crow here in the U.S., or apartheid in South Africa, if we don't remember them, we, in a sense, we re-victimize them, right? We re-traumatize them because, on one hand, they go through X experience, X trauma, and their space for collective mourning, personal mourning, the identity work that in this experience, how do I go on? How do I survive? How do I, if we don't remember, then we close off that space and we re-victimize, we re-traumatize. We may not, victims and their descendants may not remember, given a collective space to remember, but this from doing, right, through oral history, through the preservation of curriculum on their own space for this. So the attempts to silence are never really successful anyway. And it just conflict.
Dr. Duckworth, we just want to thank you so much. We're going to be taking a short break, and when we return, we're going to ask you the very last question that we have here. But again, we want to thank you for the wonderful responses you've given to the important questions that we have put forward here for discussion.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, all those who are listening to our conversation from many countries, listening to history and collective memory in conflict resolution. With Dr. Duckworth, who is a professor of conflict resolution at Nova Southeastern University. It's been a great conversation, very enriching, insightful conversation. And we want to ask Dr. Duckworth the last question. And Rene Lomachon was talking about why we should remember the traumatic events, remember forgotten genocides, and not cover them up, why we should teach them and let those who were not around at that time, those who were born afterwards, let them know what happened and the truth. And that is important. And the reason why he was saying it is because these are human beings, or the victims are human beings. So, but again, human beings perpetrated all these atrocities. I want to ask you, Dr. Duckworth, we have a similar question here in our chat box. Do you think that policymakers, some policymakers, especially in those countries, Nigeria, and in other countries like Nigeria or Rwanda right now, that policymakers intentionally manipulate the history or memory or past memory or traumatic events, intentionally manipulate others and cover them up for their own personal gains?
I'm afraid that, you know, seem to me to be just clear and clear. I think that we see a manipulation of 9/11 by the current Republican candidate. I think we've seen that on both sides of the aisle, really, but it's particularly glaring and sort of entrenched into policy by the Republican candidate currently. And when one looks at Yugoslavia, Burundi, South Africa, even in some ways of apartheid, you know, what we can perhaps see entrepreneurs on one hand see opportunity, and I think it seems to me that the rage and the desire for revenge on some of these on the part of some of these policymakers. Let's take a little bit on Milosevic, for example. I think that is a real thing for them. I don't think that it's entirely a cynical manipulation. I think that the seeking of power on the part of these policy leaders is probably out of a real fear of this other group and their own unresolved trauma and mourning in a lot of ways. And the fear of how are they going to survive and reproduce their culture if they don't have power. So on one hand, I think it's quite deliberate. Some of it may be cynical. Primarily, I think that it is driven by generations and generations of fear.
Very important. And this fear, fear that honestly needs to be transformed if we want to have and experience peace in those countries. If Nigeria wants to experience peace, Nigeria should be able to transform the fear of revenge. And also in Rwanda, Rwanda's sustainable reconciliation and sustainable peace building also relies on the transformation of fear, fear of revenge. With this, Dr. Duckworth, we just want to thank you so much for coming on our show. You are a professor of conflict resolution at Nova Southeastern University, Florida, and the author of Teaching About Terror, 9/11 and Collective Memory in U.S. Classrooms, a book that analyzes the narrative today's students are receiving about 9/11 and the implications of this for global peace and conflict. Dr. Duckworth, thank you very much for your scholarly and practical contributions to the field of conflict resolution, peace education, and sustainable peace building. And most especially, thank you for joining us on the ICM Radio program. Let's talk about it. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And finally, our thanks to you, our listeners and supporters, or those who have really supported this very initiative. Remember, you can always come back to this show on our website, www.isommediation.org. In addition to listening to the podcast, you can also get involved. You can get involved in our programs. There are many ways through which you can get involved, especially in our organization. You can join the movement by signing up for our membership, by registering for our upcoming events, especially our annual international conference on ethnic and religious conflict resolution and peace building. This year, we're going to be hosting it in New York at the Interchurch Center on November 2nd and 3rd, 2016. You can also register to participate in our training programs. We look forward, most importantly, to having you next week on Saturday for another episode of the ICM Radio program. As always, I am Basil Ogoji. Peace and blessings to you.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Thanks for listening to ICERM Radio, a global peace network dedicated to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation.
For complete information about the shows, including previous podcasts, visit the ICERM Radio website, www.icermmediation.org.
Stay connected. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And let your friends and colleagues know about us. Join us next time for another edition of ICERM Radio.
Peace to our world.
Fios is not cable. We're wired differently, which means you can get the fastest internet available with equal upload and download speeds from 50 to 500 megs. So you can upload 200 photos before your favorite song is finished. Click the ad and switch to Fios today to get our best offer ever. Fios is not cable. We're wired differently, which means you can get the fastest internet available with equal upload and download speeds from 50 to 500 megs. So you can upload 200 photos before your favorite song is finished. Click the ad and switch to Fios today to get our best offer ever.